Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In February 2014, Aspen socialite Nancy Pfister was murdered in her own home, brutally bludgeoned, wrapped in a sheet, and stuffed inside a locked closet. Fewer than 12 hours after her body was found and without any evidence, police decided a married couple from Denver had killed her. Within a few days, they arrested and charged Nancy Styler, a friend of Pfister's who had a falling out with her after a business deal went sour, and Dr. Trey Styler, Nancy's disabled husband, who recently lost the family home, his medical practice, and any hope of a peaceful retirement for himself and his wife. 11 days later, police charged Kathy Carpenter, Pfister's underpaid and overworked personal assistant and closest friend. Months later, Trey Styler, who was slowly losing his grip on reality as he battled with mental illness, confessed to the crime. Rampant speculation spread about whether he was involved at all or if his confession was that of a man on his deathbed because a medical condition appeared to have left him barely able to walk, much less carry out such a heinous crime. And in the only interview before his death, Trey gives his account of that fateful day. New York Times bestselling author Daylene Barry covers this compelling story from the inside, following the Stylers from their fairy tale life in Denver to the morning of their simultaneous arrest to Nancy's release from jail and her attempts to rebuild her shattered life. The book that we're featuring this evening is Guilt by Matrimony, with my special guest, journalist and author Daylene Barry. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Daylene Barry.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Daylene. Incredible story. Like I say, it never ceases to surprise me, some of these stories. So, and this one is very, very surprising. So let's get right to, as I spoke to in the introduction, let's talk about first about Nancy Styler and a little bit of her life. And she has a sister named Cindy and her mother's named Tess. So tell us a little bit about her life and before we talk about how her and Trey met and ventured into this life that we'll talk about in this, and you do so well in this book. So tell us a little bit about Nancy Styler before she met her husband, Trey.
She was educated in the Boston area and started working at a makeup counter at an upscale department store when she was 16. And then she went to college in France and was educated there as an anesthetist. Now in France, she would have had the equivalent of a medical degree, but when I believe it was de Gaulle kicked out all the American students, she was forced to return to the U.S., and so she finished her studies here in the U.S. and became an anesthesiologist, an instructor in the anesthesiologist program in Colorado, and that's where she met Trey Styler.
Now, tell us a little bit about Trey Styler and his life before they met.
Well, Trey came from the Oklahoma area, and he was born into a family that had made a good bit of money. They seemed to have money, but Nancy said that through his father's business that they made more money. Trey also said that before he died. And his mother was pretty frugal and was able to make a lot more money out of what she had saved and they had put into stocks and bonds. So he came from a pretty wealthy family. And the other important thing about the family is that they had a serious problem with depression. His mother, his brother, and Trey himself. And the younger brother actually committed suicide, and when the police found his brother, they called Trey to come and identify the body because their parents were in Texas on a business trip at the time.
Right. Now tell us about his successful rise in his profession, and then you can tell us about how the two met.
Well, Trey was at first not a great college student, and he actually, his father, because he wanted to party, he took him out of college and said, you need to go to work because I'm not paying for college. This is how you're going to spend my money. And so Trey went to work for a while, and while he was working, I believe as an orderly in a hospital, he decided he liked that field, and so he applied to medical school. And eventually he was accepted and became a DO. And he, from that, went into the field of anesthesiology. And what was so interesting about his work is that he was so gentle and kind that there were patients, not only people in the professional field who worked in, like nurses and other doctors, that sought out his services as an anesthesiologist, but he had a lot of patients who were pretty wealthy, and they would request him even from other hospitals at times. They refused to let anybody else do their anesthesia. And he just had this air of compassion and empathy and reassured the patient that he would take good care of them. And in addition to that, he was adept at understanding that if a person was afraid, that could actually lead to a case of being scared to death, literally being scared to death. And so he was really good at keeping them relaxed and talking them out of the fear before they had surgery, so much to the point where people who had previously been so afraid and refused to ever have surgery again, he was able to talk them back into that, and they, after that, would never use any other anesthesiologist.
Now, you talk about the gentle man that Trey Styler was and his, again, unusual treatment of patients, and that was very endearing to a lot of people, including Nancy. So tell us how they met and, again, her first reaction, again, her reaction of Trey when she did meet him.
She was teaching in the anesthesia department, and he was a resident, and so he was technically her student. And the first time she interacted with him, she heard him tell a female patient exactly what would be going on during the procedure and how he would be taking care of her, and he walked her through step by step, and Nancy said that he was just so gentle and caring. It was unlike many other of the residents that she had seen who would just simply put the mask over the patient and then count backwards without telling them anything that they were going to do. And she was very impressed by that. So over the course of about a year, they started going out, and then eventually they were separated for a while because Trey had a rotation in another part of the state in Colorado. And then they got back together several months later, started dating, and then ended up getting married a year or two later.
What was the characteristic? She found him very gentle in terms of him professionally. What was leading up to the marriage and all indications of from the beginning that they met, what was his character like?
Well, he was very kind, and he was also very gentle. Those were the two adjectives that she used to describe him over and over again. And actually, many of the professional people at the hospital he worked at, where he eventually became the chief of anesthesiology in his department, they said the same thing, that they had never seen him act in a way that was angry or caused any alarm or concern. He was just a very gentle man. In fact, Nancy was on the back end of a divorce. Her first marriage had ended, and she and her first husband divorced. And when she met Trey, he joked that he really appreciated her first husband because he kept her Nancy as a placeholder. He kept a placeholder so that Trey could slip in. And Trey never looked at himself as somebody that would win a woman like Nancy's heart because he was bookish. He was a geek. He didn't, you know, stand out in any way except this gentle, kind character that he had.
Now, we talk about they being married. They met, they married, and they also have plans for a child. So within 3 years, they have a child. So tell us a little bit about what their decision is as a couple to do now that they do have the child. And so tell us how things change as a result.
Well, they changed in the fact that Nancy had been doing work with patients, and she felt like it was not safe to continue doing that pregnant. She didn't want to put her child at risk. And so they decided together that she would leave her profession in the medical field. And that was something she wanted to do because she wanted to be a full-time mother. And at that time, she began getting into botany. And she became very skilled in the field of botany, fell in love with a flower called the Victoria Lily, which has an 8-foot in circumference, or diameter, lily pad. And these are typically grown in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. And so she fell in love with this flower, and on a trip to Amazon, at that time they could bring some home. Since then it's become illegal, but they brought home some seedlings, basically, and started planting them there. And before long, their home had become what the Denver Botanical Society called, jokingly, Denver Botanical West, because their whole garden in their backyard was built and designed to cultivate these Victoria lilies. And it was in that setting that she and her husband raised their son. Trey continued working at the head of the anesthesiology department.
Now, is this the home that they built that you talk about, and you show a photo in the book of the $2.2 million? Were they at that point where they built this dream home, including these incredible gardens, that she had become this master gardener?
Yes, and the gardens were built over a period of several years. She kept adding to them every year, and the home was that $2.2 million home, which was exquisite. Just, it had, you know, everything you could want, including an indoor waterfall. At that time, they had a theater room, which was uncommon at that time. It's more common nowadays with some homes. Just a lot of amenities in that beautiful home.
Now, in terms of lifestyle, was there anything other than this, again, the appearance of normalcy behind the scenes, raising their son, Daniel? And tell us a little bit about organics and her interest in organic agriculture and horticulture. So tell us if there was anything beyond this veil of normalcy behind the scenes.
Well, at first there was not. The only thing that was going on in the early years when their son was growing up was Nancy had become such an adept expert. I mean, she really excelled at gardening. And before long, she was teaching gardening classes. She was traveling around the country speaking to different conservatories. And in addition, she and Trey and their son Daniel were cultivating these Victoria lilies, which they would then send either the seedlings or the plants around the country, and sometimes even every year they sent them around the world to different conservatories, and they would a lot of times they didn't even charge for them. They gave them away. It was like a gift to the world, and everybody that knew their work and the extent of how much volunteerism was involved in it was just amazed at how just gracious and generous they were.
Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the bad times that begin to happen. And so let's talk about Trey's health and what eventually does happen to him in terms of his health.
Well, in 1999, he started developing, he'd had foot problems for quite a while, but nobody really knew that it was a symptom of anything. Nancy said his feet just looked weird. But he started having problems in 1999, and that was when he was having trouble basically walking and making his legs work. He noticed some muscle symptoms, things that he thought were problematic with his muscles, and so he went to one doctor after another. And the first diagnosis that he received was not actually the correct one, Nancy believes. But he ended up, the illness, the symptoms kept getting worse, and so the doctors were prescribing one medication after another just to try to help him function so that he could continue working and have a normal life. And it was during this time that he got so bad that he was having to use a scooter to get around because he would just be worn out from walking very far. He figured out one time that he was walking an average of 7 miles a day on his medical rounds to see all his patients. And so what the turning point finally came when he couldn't remember whether he had given a patient the medicine that he needed before the patient was anesthetized. And he realized in retrospect that it was a life or death decision and it was a mistake that he just couldn't live with. So he, at that time, gave up his job.
So how did that change their life at that moment?
Well, for a while it was okay because they had a lot of money in savings, but then it turned out that the insurance that he had been paying for wasn't as much as they thought it was going to be. In addition to that, he had been in the process of trying to develop this piece of computer software, and he was a part of this anesthesiology group that had formed their own corporation, and they actually hired him to finish that software, and he brought on a computer programmer to do that, to help him do that. And then somehow during the course of the next several years, what happened was, it looks like that, well, it doesn't look like this is actually what happened. The anesthesiology group claimed the software as their own, and Trey tried to take them to court to fight it, and in the ensuing lawsuit, he basically ran the family dry. He paid this attorney $800,000 to fight this case, and the attorney actually was guilty of malpractice because he didn't even do what he was hired to do. So with the money gone, then, of course, by then his job was gone. They had to give up their home and, move to a smaller place. And by then they were living on Trey's disability and what little bit of money Nancy was bringing in, which wasn't much.
You mentioned earlier about the history of his family with depression. Tell us about what ensues in terms of, again, we might be jumping a little bit ahead, but what this depression manifests in terms of a threat to the family, the suicide. So let's talk a little bit about just this depression leading to Trey's, whether it's not very serious, but it is a threat of suicide.
Yes. And actually that started when he stopped working. Until the time when while he was working, even though he was ill, he seemed to be okay. But then when he had to give up his job, he started becoming very introspective and kind of pulling away from people. He would have angry outbursts, nothing to the point of violently striking anyone, but he would just have these frustrated fits of anger where he was upset over his condition, and he said he'd be better off dead. And that seemed to be the first of it, and Nancy didn't take it very seriously. But then over time, from the illness, he became more and more depressed as the lawsuit progressed, and he ended up giving this attorney so much money, that was part of the depression too. What came first and what the end result was can be debatable, whether it was the depression and then that led to his bad decisions with the attorney, or whether it was the attorney's actions and then, that led to the depression, we don't know. But what we do know is that he was being treated for this depression, and he was taking several drugs by that time, both for what they thought was then some type of a similar form of Lou Gehrig's disease at the time, and the depression. He was being treated for all those problems.
Now, you talked about the $2.2 million home, and it's a beautiful home, and you have a great photo of it in the book. They had to sell it for $840,000, so we've already outlined the conditions that these people are in, not in great condition financially whatsoever and physically, and so they're their luck has turned, to say the least. Now, with the selling of that home, they are looking for a fresh start. So what do they, where do they look to, and what do they do in this bid for a fresh start?
Well, they actually rented a couple of different homes before they went to Aspen. And during that time, they tried a couple of businesses, one which was a printing business. The other I don't remember off the top of my head, but neither one of those lasted very long for different reasons, nothing that was essential to the outcome of the story in the book. But what they did decide, and this was Nancy's idea, she wanted to open up a medical spa because she felt that with her training that she'd received in France and her knowledge of as an esthetician, she felt that she could provide people with beauty treatments such as Botox and different things like that. And she felt like they could invest what little bit of money they had left into some equipment and training, and then they could open up a medical spa. And they weren't sure where to do it, but there was somebody in the Colorado area that suggested they go, in the Denver area, that suggested they go to Aspen. And so they checked out Aspen, and a couple of people there were very, very encouraging. One was a local businesswoman, Rita Bellino, who owns the Queen Bee. And she said, oh, yeah, you could definitely make a living here. So with that encouragement, they went up there several times and until they found a home to rent. And that's where the story started with Sister, and they plan to open their medical spa.
Now, they initially meet Nancy Pfister, and they look at, or they try to judge her character from the very beginning. Tell us about the background of Nancy Pfister, which they don't know when they first meet her, but tell us a little bit about her background that they eventually, unfortunately, find out about a little too late.
Nancy Pfister was, by everyone's account in the Aspen area, a party girl. And she was a heavy drinker. She had a problem with alcoholism. She used a lot of painkillers. She would daily take handfuls of pills with her champagne, this pink champagne that she preferred to drink. And it seemed that, according to the people that knew her well, that she would be intoxicated by noon every day.
Now, she's the goddaughter of Hunter S. Thompson. As such, she talks about her background and uses that to her advantage to gain leverage over people. And as you describe in the book, she never has her hands in her own pockets to pay for anything. So tell us about some of the dealings with people and what characterizes Nancy Pfister at this time in her life when Trey and Nancy meet her.
She's actually in the fall wanting to go to Australia because she has gotten to the point in her life where she doesn't like the cold, snowy weather in Aspen. So she was making plans to travel to Australia for a few months. She thought she might invest her mother's inheritance, which she was due to receive in November of 2013. And she wanted to get that out of the way, and then she did what she usually did in the wintertime. She put an ad in the paper to rent out her home. And the Stylers saw that ad, and they answered it, and that's how they met her. She was, unfortunately, known for kicking her tenants out early, almost without fail every time, including people that she had rented to that she considered close friends. But the Stylers, of course, being outsiders and not from the area, were not familiar with that pattern.
Now, in their first conversation, when they do answer this ad, and it looks very interesting, what is the end result of that conversation and in regards to Nancy and her enthusiasm? They've had, they went from incredible luck and fortune and wealth and affluence to the exact opposite. So she is looking for, again, this fresh start. They have been convinced to move to Aspen as that this would be a great place for those kinds of people, the kind of people and couple that they were. So tell us about this phone call they have with Nancy Pfister, and why is it so encouraging to Nancy and Trey?
Well, they couldn't find a house to rent that would, one, either accommodate Trey's disability. He couldn't do stairs well. He could do them, but he couldn't do them well. And so they wanted something that would accommodate him. But in addition to that, he had an allergy, a cat allergy. So a lot of the homes that they looked at were had been inhabited with cats. So it kind of made them a place difficult to find. And so when they came across the ad for Pfister's home, Nancy actually called, and Nancy Pfister thought that it was serendipity, karma, if you will, that they wanted a home right away and that she had one to rent and that it met the criteria, supposedly met the criteria. So she told them to come right over because there was another family that was scheduled to show up and looked at it, but that couple had children and she didn't really want anybody with children in her home. And so she encouraged them to come over, and when they met her, she had the usual champagne in her glass, and she was very, very bubbly and social, and they took to her right away. She seemed very friendly and gracious, and they liked that. They thought that it was a warm welcome. And in addition to that, when she heard what their plans were, she told them that they could open up their medical spa in her home. And they thought that was just perfect because it would save them the cost of renting both a location for the spa and a place for them to live.
Now, Nancy Pfister is a really gregarious, like you say, a party girl. She's drinking champagne. And again, very outgoing and friendly, and promising Nancy and Trey that they're welcome to come into her home and set up their business. But soon after, the real character of Nancy Pfister is evident. And what little things do Nancy and Trey find out almost immediately?
Well, they found out that she was indeed, as you would say, a cheapskate. She didn't want to pay for anything out of pocket. She would offer, she would not offer, but she would ask them, like, to pick her up some of her champagne that she liked when one of them was making a trip to Denver, and they thought that that meant she would repay them. And, of course, she thought that meant, in her mind, that that was just a gift that they were getting for her. And so little things like that happened. But in addition to that, she seemed to be very overly friendly with men, not with women, but with men. And Nancy was never jealous of Pfister's behavior, even though it extended to Trey. And Trey wasn't the least bit looking at it as something that he would exercise, you know, the right to help himself to what this woman seemed to be offering, as she did a lot of the men who showed up there. But Nancy was just taken back by how blatant it was. And they saw several men come and go, different men that she would spend the night with there in her home. And it just was not what they expected.
With this as well, with the drinking and the lifestyle and the various men dropping by, and then you talk about the arguments that she would have, but also that not so gradually, the Trey and Nancy realized that they were almost her slave, that she would expect them to rub her feet, rub her shoulders, go get this, go do that. So a lot of chauffeuring, a lot of personal things that she would get them to do. So they realized that this relationship came with many, many strings attached, didn't it?
That, yes, and in fact, that was part of the problem, and that was the growing frustration for Nancy Seiler, not so much for Trey, because Trey actually wasn't around as much as Nancy was. He was going back and forth getting furniture and taking care of business where they'd lived before, but Nancy was there much more and expected to basically, be her servant.
Now, tell us about the circumstances that Nancy Pfister introduces Kathy Carpenter to Trey and Nancy.
Kathy Carpenter was Nancy Pfister's closest friend, and she was also like an unpaid personal assistant. She helped Nancy with her banking because Kathy was a bank teller at Alpine Bank, and she had worked there for several years, I believe about 15 years. And she introduced her to Nancy and to Trey, and they actually shared the care of Sister's Labradoodle, a black Labradoodle whose name was Gabe. He was a puppy. And so Nancy and Trey met Kathy under those circumstances, and before long, the four of them were very, very attached to Gabe, not just Sister and Carpenter, but also Nancy and Trey.
Part of the attraction with, as friends, between Kathy Carpenter and Nancy Pfister was that, of course, being a party person, Nancy Pfister was a drinker and Kathy was a drinker. But tell us about the why things were a strain between in the relationship, especially with Kathy and Nancy at that time.
Well, they became estranged. They were strained because Kathy was trying to become sober, and she had started going to AA meetings, and she was getting her life back on track. And she had a very hard time maintaining her sobriety when she was around Pfister. So she was trying to put some distance between herself and Nancy Pfister. And that actually came into play more after Pfister left for Australia, but it had already started a little bit before Pfister went to Australia. And so Nancy saw that and thought that it was, you know, she's a health care worker first and foremost. She takes care of people. And so she could discern that Kathy needed to be stronger, and she tried to encourage her at different times when she could to do what she had to and to not let Pfister have that hold over her anymore.
Now, we talked about Nancy's plan to go to Australia. So in this ensuing period between Trey and Nancy moving into this home, the promises of letting Trey and Nancy or Nancy operate her spa out of this home, what happened in that ensuing period before she left Australia? Was there opinion of the prospect of this business being open in her home still on the forefront? Did they still believe that? But what things had changed in terms of their assessment of the relationship with Nancy before she left Australia?
Well, in addition to the feeling of servitude and of noticing that she was entitled and expected the world to revolve around her, they also realized that as soon as they had paid the first $6,000 that they owed her, that she became a little bit difficult. And by that, I mean that she would become angry, and she would be, what's the word? She would be belittling to them, especially to Nancy Pfister, not Nancy Styler, not so much Trey. She definitely did not treat Trey as badly as she did his wife. And then there was the sense that she was not going to be, it was kind of like her stories would change, and they didn't know whether she was forgetting things because of the alcoholism or what. They thought maybe they could help her at first, Trey especially, but then they came to realize by the time she left for Australia that she was pretty much beyond help, and they just wanted to be able to open their spa and live in her home. And then, you know, when she came back 6 months later, originally that was the plan. They would, you know, have to have something different between by then. But when she left for Australia in November, yes, the plan was still for them to open the spa in her home.
Now let's fast forward a little bit to what happens during the trip that would have alarmed them or changed anything at all, and then the return from Australia and her behavior, Nancy's.
Well, within 2 weeks of leaving for Australia, they were getting emails from her demanding the rest of the money. And the total money that they owed from the time they moved in when she left for Australia, they actually were living there free until she left for Australia, because that was the terms that she gave them, was if you move in here and help me get ready for Australia, you know, you can live here a month free. But anyway, there was a three-month period, and they were going to pay first, last, and present month's rent. So that would have been a total of $12,000. And so they gave her $6,000 before she left, and they were getting the other $6,000. There was a little bit of a lapse, so it wasn't coming as quickly as they thought it would, but she became serious. And within 2 weeks, she was demanding the money. And within probably a week after that, she was demanding that they leave, basically saying they were trailer trash, they needed to go back where they came from. And by the end of December, she was just all out in war with them through these emails, having her attorney call them and send them harassing letters. She had looped in with CCs in her emails, the sheriff, the former sheriff, Bob Broaddus, some of the deputies. She had even gone so far as to ask law enforcement to evict them because they weren't paying, which wasn't true at all. They were late in paying, but they actually did pay. But she just changed. It was just amazing, her change after she left for Australia.
There was a point when Nancy bragged to Nancy Styler that she was close friends or family friends with the sheriff, Joe DeSilva. Is that correct?
Yes, she did. In fact, she said that she would go down there and shoot the bull all the time.
Now, tell us about Nancy's return, and at that point, Nancy and Trey are planning to do what?
Well, by the time Pfister was, let me back up a minute. Nancy and Trey realized in January, it was not too long after January 1st, that they couldn't stay there and that they had to try to get out as soon as they could. So they actually began looking for other places to live. But in the meantime, Pfister kind of pulled the rug out from under them and gave them 4 days' notice that she was returning on or about February 22nd. And so they, Kathy Carpenter, a couple of other friends of Carpenter's came up and helped them load up the U-Haul to get all their stuff out. And then in those days when they were moving, Carpenter and the Stylers traded cars because Carpenter had a station wagon that would accommodate more things in it, and she took their Jaguar to the airport on that Saturday to pick Pfister up as she returned from Australia.
And tell us, at that point, what was Kathy saying to Nancy in terms of about her friend Pfister?
She was telling Nancy that Pfister wanted her to get everything set up for her return, have her champagne on ice, have her bed made up the way she wanted it, have all their things out. And then at the last minute, she wanted to know if they didn't want to leave the home that weekend when she got in, if they would pay whatever the rate was for the Hotel Jerome, which was, I think, like maybe $2,000 a night, that she would just stay there and they could stay there for the weekend and continue moving. Because they weren't completely moved. Like I said, she only gave them 4 days' notice. But then after they didn't do that, of course, they went to the cheapest hotel they could find, the Aspinall Lodge, and they moved everything they could into storage and went to the motel and hoped that everything would be okay when she came back, because what they had done after she left for Australia was they put all her valuables in the upstairs closet and locked it, and Carpenter helped with this. And they did that to make sure everything was protected and nothing was damaged or stolen, and that was what she requested, and they did that. So they had to put everything back up. They had to hang pictures on the wall. They had to move furniture. They had to get everything back in order. Nancy had washed all of Pfister's linens, and she had put them back in the house instead of having them in the basement where they'd been stored. Everything was just put back in order. And so they were in the hotel hoping that everything was okay. And what ultimately happened was that Sunday when Carpenter and Trey traded vehicles back, Carpenter handed him an envelope on which Pfister had written on the back that they owed her about $14,000 in damages. And the damages were totally made up. There wasn't anything significant they had done that would have caused them to owe her $14,000. But what she said was is that since they hadn't gotten their spa equipment out of her home yet, which they hadn't even had a chance to use because, as it turned out, there was a water problem that wouldn't let them set it up, she was going to hold on to that equipment. And it was about $100,000, $150,000 worth of equipment. And so what Trey realized, and he didn't share this with Nancy because Nancy was becoming depressed over the whole situation, what Trey realized was that if Pfister kept that equipment, they wouldn't be able to support themselves.
Now, they did talk to some people. They did talk to Susan Warko, and again, there's dispute on what was said in the phone call, but apparently the son, Sam, said, you know, if anything goes wrong there, if anything's taken from there, they'll blame you. So in response to what Nancy said she heard from Sam, what did they do in terms of contacting the police and why?
Well, yeah, and that was a very important part of the story that a lot of the media didn't have. They didn't have the details of when they reported on this case, but Nancy actually called an attorney because a couple of people, including one of Pfister's closest friends, advised her to check with an attorney and see what their rights were, and also to call the sheriff's department and ask if they would send a deputy up when they interacted with Pfister after her return, so that there would be, you know, protection there if she grew angry and accused them of anything. So Nancy made that call to the sheriff's department, and she called twice, 2 days in a row, and she was told that what they had to do was show up, and that if there was a problem, then the police would come to their assistance.
At that time, at that moment in time, because this will be important, what was Styler's health, what was his actual health like, and in terms of his bad health, what did that prevent him from doing in practical terms?
Well, his health was bad. I don't think it was as bad as everyone thought it was, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly, so you might need to redirect me, but he was still having trouble to some extent with stairs, but he was seen lifting boxes as they were moving. People saw him lifting boxes. And according to their son, Daniel, there would be a lot of times when Trey actually could do a lot physically, but then he would pay for it because he would be so wiped out afterwards. Is that what you meant?
Right. Yes. Yes. So let's talk about the moving day and what Trey and Nancy experienced, especially what Nancy saw and experienced that day. They had hired some movers to help them with this move as well. So tell us about what happened that day and Nancy's experience in that move.
Okay, well, they had been moving for the 4 days notice that they had, and then they were actually staying in a motel that Saturday night when Pfister came back. That was her first night in the Aspinall. And then Sunday night, they didn't hear from her, and on Monday morning they went up to her house to try to move the moving van that had gotten stuck in the snow and left there. And when they knocked on the door, she wasn't around. Well, actually, let me step back. Monday morning, I'm getting ahead of myself. Monday afternoon was when this happened. I'm sorry. Monday afternoon was when this happened. And they went up there, and nobody came to the door, and so they let themselves in because they wanted to try to get the rest of their stuff, and if she wasn't there, it would be easier for them to get it. And what they were met with was a mess from Gabe, Pfister's Labradoodle puppy, who had basically, you know, peed all over the place and made a mess everywhere and torn food down to eat. And he didn't have hardly any water, and so they were both upset over that and couldn't understand why Pfister, who really, really loved this dog, would not have taken better care of him. And so they were immediately wondering, you know, what had she done? Why was she not taking care of the dog? Where was she? Had she run off with a guy? Had she, you know, gone somewhere and forgot to tell somebody? They just didn't know.
With that as well, they saw that they thought it was unusual, but at the same time, you write in the book that part of Nancy's behavior was this sort of irresponsibility. So did they reconcile both of those things with a little bit of the information, despite the unusual nature of just leaving this dog to its own devices?
Yeah, they did actually, and I'm sure it was easy to tell themselves, well, she's done this before. She had actually done it with her daughter when her daughter was little. That was something that was that Pfister even wrote about in a semi-autobiographical play she wrote. But it was common knowledge that she had done that with her own daughter, and that she would, you know, go away, you know, now and then, and just no one would know where she was. So they did say, well, that's probably what's happened. But at the same time, the dog not being cared for was what made them worry that there was something wrong. And also there was a smell, and Nancy chalked it up to Gabe having gone to the bathroom in the house. Trey didn't have any sense of smell, so he couldn't smell it. But Nancy did, and she thought it was, nothing major, but you know, just a nasty smell. She cleaned everything up and took care of it so it would be in good shape. But she also called Carpenter and said, you know, I don't know what happened to Nancy, and we need to find out, you know, what to do about Gabe. And so they began trying to track her down through phone calls to people.
Now, Nancy Pfister has a daughter named Juliana. So tell us, who looks for Nancy first, and what do they do in that investigation to find out where she is? Who's looking for her first?
Well, on Tuesday, Kathy Carpenter and Nancy talk repeatedly, and they decide that if they can't find Kathy or Nancy by that evening, that Kathy will come home before she goes home, get the dog, Gabe, and take him to her house. But what she does in the meantime is she talks to Patricia Stranahan, and Patricia Stranahan and her husband, George, raised Juliana. They were kind of like her godparents. And
right.
She just happens to come into the bank to make a deposit, and Kathy flags her down and starts telling her that she can't find Nancy, and even Patty Stranahan isn't worried because she knows Nancy's like that, kind of flighty. And so Kathy says to her, would you please call and see if you can find out where she might be? And so that's the first thing that she does. And, of course, later, you know, that day and the next day, no one has found her.
So tell us about how everything proceeds in terms of that search and who actually makes this grim discovery.
Well, while Kathy's talking to Patty Stranahan, Nancy is talking to Susan Laskow and a couple of other people, and says, you know, we don't know where Nancy's at. We're surprised that she left Gabe. It's just not like her. And, you know, they went from Monday afternoon to Tuesday evening to Wednesday morning. And then, you know, it's kind of become apparent that something has happened to her because it's just not like no one to hear from her. And so at that point on Wednesday afternoon, that was the day that Nancy and Kathy had decided that if no one had heard from Pfister, they couldn't find her, that Kathy would get Gabe. So she actually does go to Nancy's Buttermilk home to get Gabe, and when she walks in, the smell just hits her in the face, and she realizes it's coming from the bedroom, and when she gets to the bedroom, she realizes that something's wrong. She doesn't have the key to the closet, but that seems to be where the smell's coming from, so she runs home and gets the key. She's on the phone to her mom, to Patty Stranahan, to a couple of different people while she's doing this, and she's clearly already very worried, scared. She doesn't know what's going on. They're trying to tell her, look, it's all right. Your imagination's getting the best of you. She's starting to have a panic attack because she'd had breathing problems and actually had almost died while Pfister was in Australia, and Trey had saved her life and gotten her medical care into the hospital. But she's having this breathing panic attack where she can't breathe. And then she goes and gets the key and comes back and finds Pfister's body in the closet.
Now, right away, the police are called, and this main character, Joe Da Silva, and you mentioned a deputy's name as well, so they are familiar with Pfister. And so what is their reaction?
Well, DeSalvo and Brad Gibson, Brad Gibson's like the chief deputy. Well, he's a detective. He's not the chief deputy, but he's a detective. And he, they think that almost within, I'd say within about 2 hours, they think that the Skylars had something to do with it. And that is in large part because when Kathy Carpenter finds sister's body in the closet, she loses it. She just has a nervous breakdown almost on the spot. You can hear it in her voice on the 911 call as she's driving away, fleeing for her own life, thinking that someone, the killer, is probably after her and she needs to get to safety. You can hear all that in her voice on the 911 call. And she is, when the police take her to the hospital, she's taken to the hospital and they kind of man guard there and try to get her to talk. You know, she's heavily medicated. She's tranquilized. But what she says during that time while she's tranquilized is that they said they were going to kill her. They hated her. You know, what if they did something to her? Now, she's talking out of her head, but the police immediately took it seriously. And by the next morning, had basically arrested the Skylars.
Before we get to that, you talk about it a little bit later, but there is a conversation, so maybe you could set me straight on this. There's a conversation with Patrick Carney. So who does Nancy talk with Patrick Carney? Because this becomes very incredibly important. So when does this phone call happen? Before we talk about the contents of that, but when was that phone call made?
Well, Patrick told police that sister left him a message at 2:30 in the morning on Monday, February 24th, asking for a ride later that day. He was in
right.
the hospital. He had shattered his collarbone. And
right.
He tried to call her back on Monday night, sent her a text message, didn't get her.
So when does he actually have a conversation with Nancy Skylar, though, about this? Or who does he have a conversation with?
Yeah, he did have a conversation with Nancy Skylar, and that would have been, let's see here. I believe that was Tuesday. Yes, because he was in the hospital on Monday, and after they discharged him, he went to get his car, and then he drove up to check on sister because he thought that she needed a ride to town. That's what she'd said in her message to him because her car was snowed in. And so when he gets there, he sees that they're moving. And what he says to police, at least, is that it's interesting because what Patrick says in his interview with police is not what they say back to him. And so before you know it, the whole interview has the police basically leading him to say, well, yeah, they did say that she was there and in the upstairs and for me not to go up there and check on her. But that's not what Patrick told police. He basically told police, no, we didn't. They said that we didn't see her.
Yeah, it's very interesting. What you have in the book is you talk about the specifics of how they did this in terms of they already assume that they have their suspect.
Yeah.
So then they
yeah.
ask leading questions. And when he is unsure of certain things, they disregard the inconsistencies, which, again, is not great police work at all. And then, again, which is not good police work, leading questions. And never ask him for a polygraph. So never, ever clarify exactly what specifically he did say. And it's important because he is speaking about statements regarding Nancy and her whether Nancy Skylar and Trey Skylar even saw Nancy Pfister. So it's very, very important what he does say and what he doesn't say, and it's very interesting how you show how they can come to this kind of conclusion. So tell us about Joe DeSilva, and you talk about the quest to have these people arrested sooner than they actually were, but there was something holding them back. So tell us a little, it's very fascinating about this adamant Joe DeSilva and his quest to have these people arrested very, very quickly and have this case solved.
Well, they found her body around, I'm going to say 6 o'clock on that Wednesday night, and by 5:30 a.m. the next morning on Thursday, they were busting into the motel room where the Stylers were, and they immediately, you know, had them both get naked, take pictures of them, which was just completely beyond police protocol for male officers to be even in the room when that happens to a female suspect. And then they take them, separate them, question them. And DeSalvo is involved in the questioning of Trey. Interestingly, Nancy doesn't get the same kind of treatment Trey does, but DeSalvo is basically in Trey's face saying, "We know you did this. We know your wife helped. We know you're responsible. Tell us why you did it. Tell us what happened." He takes more of an active role in the investigation that most sheriffs do that I've been familiar with in my work.
You also talk about the things that he does say when he's yelling in his face, is that we have the DNA on you. And also that you failed the polygraph.
Right.
You don't talk about that,
that
time of whether that's true or not, but it seems like that's not true at that point, is it?
No DNA at that point. The DNA takes longer than they had time to get DNA.
Did he fail the polygraph at that time as well?
We don't know, because the defense team was never provided with results of the polygraph.
Wow. Now, you talk about the ordeal, and you describe in great detail this ordeal at the motel with Trey and Nancy. So you also talk about, again, their naivety before they contact their son, Daniel, or Nancy talks to her son, Daniel, about they're just being cooperative. They're, again, many people are familiar with this sort of thing where people think they're innocent. Well, geez, I'm going to be exonerated very quickly. So tell us a little bit about this naivety and their approach in terms of not calling a lawyer right away.
Well, it was the same thing with Kathy Carpenter, but they felt like they were innocent. They didn't have anything to hide. They were telling the truth. And so why did they even need an attorney? Because innocent people don't go to jail. And so even though I believe Nancy especially was in a state of shell shock from what happened that morning, being forced to stand naked in front of a room full of male officers and have her pictures taken, I believe that her tone of voice, and some of this came from the investigator that worked for the defense, David Olmstead, you know, it was just they were so respectful. They were appalled. They couldn't understand why they were being treated that way. But they were so respectful, and they wanted to help. You know, they were willing to do whatever they could to help. Nancy was like, you know, I'll tell you anything you need. I want to help find her. We've been worried about her for the last 3 days.
In this investigation, too, police do find many, many people that had the same kind of, again, sentiment that they would like to kill these people or wring their neck. But with that information, the police did not look at anyone else as a possibility. And in fact, tell us about the theory that they have in regards to who murdered Nancy Pfister and why.
Well, the theory is just really bizarre. It goes beyond any police work I've ever seen before. But there were several people who said that they harbored ill will towards Pfister. They even said the same thing that Nancy Stylers did, I'd like to kill her. There were many strange men that she had slept with over the years, and all of them, there was even a serial killer. One woman called and gave them a tip that there was a serial killer who had attacked women that looked and were about the same age as Pfister. And the police followed up on those leads half-heartedly, but they never, ever questioned or gave polygraphs to any of the people, including Patrick Carney, who admitted that, you know, he took Pfister out to dinner every Thursday night and that, no, she would never stick her hand out to pay, that he always was expected to pay the bill. Or another friend, a male friend, that would, you know, take her home and make sure she got to bed safe after she was on a bender. The police never, ever looked at those people seriously, even though, you know, to my way of thinking as an investigative reporter, it seems like they were equally possible suspects to the Stylers. So what the police did instead was just bizarre. They looked at the fact that the Stylers and Carpenter had traded cars. They looked at the fact that when Nancy went into the motel to get the motel room, She wrote down on her the intake sheet that they were driving a Subaru, because they were driving Carpenter's Subaru. They looked at the fact that Nancy and Kathy had exchanged a lot of text messages about how Nancy had been fixing Kathy's hair and makeup, and Kathy was really appreciative of that, and everybody was telling her how great she looked. They looked at all those things, which were in and of themselves nothing that would have anything to do with Pfister's murder at all. They looked at those as a conspiracy to kill the woman.
As a result, there are arrests made, and as such, tell us about that, but also tell us about the hammer that's found on February 28th.
Well, Nancy and Trey, even though it was not officially labeled an arrest on that Thursday morning when the police came into their motel room, it was an arrest because they were detained and they couldn't leave. But then the police let them go because they really had no evidence that night, and then they arrested them again the following Monday. By then, there had been DNA found, both Pfister's and Trey's, in a garbage bag where some of Pfister's and Styler's belongings had been tossed. The defense team thought that the Stylers at that point were being set up when they came into the case, because there was nothing of Carpenter's found, and they thought perhaps Carpenter was setting them up. But she was arrested 11 days later as, part of the conspiracy that the three of them had supposedly had to kill Pfister. But this hammer that was found in this trash bag that was dumped in a Carbondale garbage can, and Carbondale is the little town that is outside of Aspen, and it's actually just the little town where the Aspenaut Lodge is that the Stylers were staying in. And the trash can wasn't too far from their motel, so that looked really suspicious. But the hammer had been used by Trey both when Pfister left, and he was doing different things to the house to take the pictures down off the wall, but it was definitely used right before she came back. Of course, they had to take all those pictures out of storage and hang them back up on the walls again.
Why was that hammer so important in terms of evidence? Or did they feel
because,
it was so important?
Because it was the murder weapon. It was what had, they found some of Pfister's DNA on it, and it was the murder weapon. That's the conclusion they came to.
Now, you have a very profound, this is a very profound book, but a very profound moment in the book where the detectives, the police, are looking at Nancy as this accomplice. They have, like you say, evidence that links Trey, they believe, and they believe that based on witnesses that he has the ability, despite he talking about a disability, that to be able to do this. So they have a meeting with Nancy, and they show her the crime scene photos, and they're gauging her reaction. Tell us about that.
Garth McCarty, one of her two defense attorneys, he actually said he could not get out of his mind the response that he saw on Nancy's face when he brought his iPad with all the photos from the crime scene and saw her basically look through them. And he said for probably 20, 30 minutes, she was silent. And he said, Nancy Styler is just not a woman that doesn't speak. She speaks, a lot. She talks a lot. She's a very social person herself. But he said he could tell by the horror that he saw on her face that there was no way she had ever seen that dead woman. So at that point, he believed conclusively that she was innocent.
Now, with this, you talk about the day that she gets information. I guess I'm obviously fast forward here, but how do they get to the point where Nancy Styler is being released? And again, another profound part of the book where she is told she is being released and believes in her mind, again, naivety, that her and Trey are going to finally walk out of this cell, this jail, exonerated. So tell us about what circumstances lead to Nancy being released, and tell us about that scene that you create in the book.
Well, all along, Nancy has been saying to anybody that would listen, look, when the police get the DNA, science is going to prove that we didn't do this, because there's no way that the DNA will lie, that the evidence, the the medical, or not the medical, but the science is not going to prove that we did it, because we didn't. And the police will know that, so we'll get out. But then they didn't get out. Until finally, after a little over 100 days, Beth Krulowitz, Nancy's other defense attorney, shows up in her cell one morning and has a change of clothes that she's gotten for her at a thrift shop, some flip-flops, and a letter. And she explains to Nancy, Garth gets there shortly after, and by that time Beth had explained to Nancy that she's being released, the charges will be dropped, and that Trey had pled guilty to get her released and to have the police exonerate her. And so she reads the letter, and the letter sounds like Trey has basically taken the fall to get her out of prison, or get her out of jail at that time. She is immediately horrified, and her attorneys, by then the two of them are there together, Garth and Beth, and they are terrified by her reaction, because she's crying, she can't understand, she doesn't know what he's really done, she can't understand or make sense of it, and they're afraid that she is going to do something to sabotage his confession. They don't know what, but you know, they ask that the jail officials keep an eye on her until she's released later that day, because they don't want her to do anything that would be you know, out of her head, some type of crazy reaction in response to what Trey did by confessing.
Now, her reaction, again, the audience might be asking, well, what? Again, a confession? But he writes a 3-page letter, and what exactly is in that letter? And again, because it'll be evident that there's a reason why Nancy doesn't either completely believe it, or believe it to be a confession, or has some idea that maybe Trey is falling on his sword, as you mentioned in the book. Tell us what's written in that letter and why it isn't so clear exactly what he is saying in that letter.
Because he tells her that, I know you're innocent, and I know that I'm innocent. You should believe that. Basically, I think that's what you're referring to. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So she's still not clear. She's, again, to add to her horror, is that she's finally being released, but her husband, who's disabled, her soulmate, the person that she loves and believes is innocent, is still in this jail. So she's devastated, even though she's elated to finally be out and to be treated like a human being again, and afforded those little comforts like bed sheets and clean clothes and pillows.
Right. Right. It's like simultaneously the best and the worst day of her life together, wrapped up in one.
Now, she is told that she is to be released, and she is released, and that she's also told that Trey is going to plead guilty and receive a 20-year sentence. And again, incredible in the book, where the lawyer tells Nancy, geez, this is a fantastic deal that he's getting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Beth and Garth don't want her to do anything to compromise, to try to, like, you know, they had this thought, Garth told me, that she might suddenly decide to plead guilty to keep Trey from having to take the fall for her. She truly thought that her husband, this man that she'd only ever been with intimately since she married him, and the same was true of him, that he loved her so much that he was willing to take the fall so that she could be free. And she, you know, couldn't comprehend that he would do that. She was also terrified because of his tendency to have depression. And I'm not sure, am I getting at what you're thinking of, Dan?
Yes, yes. Now tell us how the whole entire case and trial proceeds from this point, with Trey deciding to confess, with Nancy distraught, with constant contact with her grown son, Daniel. There you do talk about in the book also that, again, the police didn't look at people that really had a hate on for Nancy Pfister, including her own sister, Suzanne. So tell us how what happens next in this case?
Well, you can imagine that their son Daniel and his mom Nancy were just beside themselves. But at the same time, Daniel couldn't understand why his dad would phrase a letter like that if he hadn't actually, he thought that there was something that wasn't quite right. And so the two of them decided that they were going to fight to get him free. And this is a family who had been involved in the legal system for probably 15 years in terms of fighting first one battle to get the rights to the computer software, then another battle for a malpractice against the corrupt attorney. And then there was a house that they had lived in and gotten poisoned from carbon monoxide, and they looked at that as being a possible legal action. So they'd been involved with different lawyers, all of whom had mostly not been able to help them in one way or another, and they'd been left in, you know, a destitute situation and out of, you know, all their money, basically. So they told his attorney, Tina Fang, that they were going to fight to free him. And at that point, she went to Trey and told him that. And then, do you want me to ultimately say how it turned out?
That's up to you.
Do we want to keep the readers?
You know, I know that we talked about the interview. We mentioned it, the interview that he has on his deathbed. So maybe let's not, you know, leave something for somebody to discover.
Sure.
But tell us about how his health gets, and why does his health get to such a credible, dire state so quickly? Is there some, again, I mean, it may sound like an obvious question, but...
Oh, well, Trey is stuck in prison, and he calls it an intellectual wasteland. When I interviewed him in April, I spent about 9 hours that day in the prison. Eight of those hours we were talking, and he was being videotaped during our interview. But you can tell from what little bit he was able to do inside the prison. First of all, his wife had no money because when she was arrested, she couldn't work. When she got out, she had a record. She couldn't, that record wasn't immediately expunged and the case sealed. So anytime she would try to get work, you know, any employers who did a background check would find that she was, you know, had a charge of murder against her. So she was living back home in Boston with her mother, had no money to speak of. And most inmates have family members. I don't know if most of them do, but some of them have family members who will pay for things like them to have a TV or to have a newspaper delivered,
right,
things like that. And he had no money because Nancy had no money. And so he was this very, very intellectually stimulated person who, for the first time in his life, had nothing to stimulate him. And he was living inside a prison where the only job he had that they would give him was basically to wipe down his cell, which just took a few minutes a day. That was it. That's the only worthwhile means of spending his time he had every day. And he was simply desperate to get out and to be with his wife, the woman that he loved more than anything else in the world.
And so what did he do in terms of that quest?
Ultimately?
Yes.
Well, he talked about... he wrote letters to his attorney, Tina Fang. He talked to other attorneys, and nobody would talk to him. He wanted to try to appeal. He basically confessed to Nancy. I'm not sure how much to say, but he eventually took his own life, of course.
Now, maybe we should have left that as a spoiler, you know, not a spoiler, but...
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay, because what I wanted to also say, that the part of this we've kind of not talked about at all is the media and how they treated this case and how they treated this couple and their involvement in this as well, in terms of maybe, tell us a little bit about this. I don't want to even try to forge a question on that one.
Secondary to the shoddy police work that was done, because it's clear to me, after looking through the police and the prosecution's own internal documents in this case, that they had tunnel vision from the moment they found Sister's body, the police did. But secondary to that grave mistake and unprofessional behavior was the media's inability or unwillingness to try to track down people who would tell the real story about the Stylers. Now, there were some media outlets that did, probably the Denver newspapers did a better job, certainly than the Aspen newspapers did. But they took at face value everything the police said. And part of the problem was that the case had been sealed at the request of the defense, which didn't help the Stylers any, but really the media didn't try very hard to point out that this woman had a problem, that there were a lot of people in town that didn't like her. It's not easy to speak ill of the dead, but it is true. In fact, one of the people that I interviewed said there was no love lost between Nancy Pfister and the people in Aspen. It's not easy to find anybody who, by that time in her life, considered her a friend. There were people that, thought that she was great to have at a party, but those people didn't consider her a friend. And so for the media not to dwell on any of that, but to point out that she was, you know, Aspen's child, you know, and to really, they really laid it out as though this woman had been horribly wronged by these two people and Kathy Carpenter, and how could anybody do this to our daughter, whose parents started Buttermilk Mountain? And they just kind of, they just didn't do a really good job of investigating it. They could have found out a lot of this themselves.
Now, you spoke about your interview with Trey Styler. How heartbreaking was that, knowing everything that you knew about Nancy's predicament, the treatment of Nancy, the treatment of Trey, and this, again, person that you just mentioned, that there was no love lost over this woman. She was an antagonistic, belligerent entitled woman. But tell us about how, because you talk about it in the book, how heartbreaking was it to speak to him under all of those conditions?
Well, he was a pretty broken man, and yet he still had some hope that he would see his wife again. I think it was he was clinging to a thread by that time. In fact, he broke down and cried several times during the interview. Part of his tears came when he was talking about his early days as a doctor who had to proclaim these babies. He had to basically announce them dead, these little tiny babies that were born and had heart problems and really didn't have a chance of living, but he would have to bring in the parents and dress the babies up and then, you know, issue the death certificates, and how difficult that was and just a horrible part of his job. But then he broke down because he realized that the date of the interview was the anniversary date of when he and Nancy went on their first date, and he went home that night and called his mother and said, "I met the woman I'm going to marry." And he said, "I can't believe that I've basically thrown away my life with her, and my son won't talk to me, and I'll never see him again, and, look at what I've done to my family." And so I tried to tell him, you know, that there was still hope and, you know, that he would get to see Nancy again. It wasn't that she didn't want to see him. She just didn't have any money to fly out to the prison, and in time she would have, and that she definitely still loved him and wanted to come out and see him. And he also felt, because by then he wasn't getting any responses from his attorney, and he couldn't get any other attorneys to hear him. And he actually believed that he had reason to appeal, because he felt like the police had and the prosecution had gotten him to, they'd enticed him into confessing, because he in turn got Nancy free. That was the price of his confession. And so he actually believed that there was room for an appeal. And I think, I don't care, you know, any inmate should have legal legal counsel. And at that point in his life, he didn't. And so he was really desperate. It was just a heartbreaking day. It's really terrible, especially, you know, considering what happened later.
Mm-hmm. In the end of your book, you talk about the tunnel vision that impaired law enforcement officers who worked the case. And if they would have waited for the results of the Stylers phone analysis before rushing to their conclusion, that they would have known that Nancy was telling the truth and the arrest would have never happened. Could you explain that for us?
Yes. The defense team had an analyst look at the phone records. I mean, the prosecution did the same thing, but in the prosecution records, the case files, there was no evidence, and if it was there, they didn't share it with the defense, and that's possible because there were a lot of things that were done wrong with this case from the police and prosecution side. But the defense found that there was a cell phone that put Nancy in her motel room the morning of February 24th, that Monday morning, when Sister Ashley was being murdered. And the police, the only thing they looked at was that one of Nancy's cell phones, and she had two, one of her cell phones was being pinged. It was pinging from the area of Sister's home. But what they either didn't realize or they didn't share with the defense was that her second cell phone was making phone calls from the motel room at the same time Sister was being killed. And that's because Nancy Stylers was there making those calls for different things that she was trying to track down that morning.
Right. Yeah, incredible. Incredible story. What were your conclusions after this? After, I know this is every true crime book, every book that you write takes a little bit out of you. And I've talked to other authors that some books just send them over the edge and they don't want to write any more true crime. What was your conclusion out of this? And just what did you take away from this case after immersing yourself in it so heavily and writing this book?
Well, I took away a couple of things. It was very draining, especially after I did the interview with Trey. And I may take a break from true crime. I mean, I've done two pretty horrific true crime books lately, back to back. And it does take a lot out of you. But the takeaway, I think, is that we may know the people that we love very, very well, better even than they know themselves. But that doesn't mean that we can save them. And it also doesn't mean that they can save themselves. And sometimes people simply crack. And there's not a thing we can do about it.
Wow. Yeah, this is incredible. This I got to say that this is one of those cases where you really do see a love story here, a very enduring love story, and a story of success, of nice people set to do some really great things, a nice family, nice intentions, and circumstances, and their life goes, in this particular case, from fairy tale to nightmarish in short order. And Nancy was released from prison, but I'm sure that everybody involved with this was touched and was led down from that, again, that fairy tale life to this nightmarish existence. And no good came of this, really, out of this story, other than, again, to show the heights that people can go from that, again, fairy tale life to this nightmare ending. So, again, not a happy story at all, but is, I don't know, maybe a cautionary tale for some of us, and certainly an incredible tale. And I want to thank you for coming on and talking about Guilt by Matrimony, and truly an incredible story.
Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Well, you have a great evening, and I hope to talk to you again soon. And again, thank you for this interview, and you have a great evening.
You too. Thank you, Dan.
Good night.